From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a federal appeals court upholds Michigan's EM law.
You have no rights. I mean, basically, this is another form of apartheid.
Plus, something fishy in support for a proposed natural gas pipeline?
An Ohio resident purportedly wrote a letter August 15th in support of this Nexus pipeline to FERC. Mr. England died 18 years ago.
Parents of a child with special needs want their child in a general ed classroom. The school district says no. Then what?
My view is that the process, from the parents' point of view, is fundamentally broken. It's also expensive for districts.
And Parallel 45, Northern Michigan's professional theater company.
Let's not just do the same old, same old. Let's try something new and see what the response is.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at special education in Michigan. What recourse do parents of kids with special needs have when parents disagree with the school's education plan? And why is a proposed pipeline getting letters of support from the deceased? But first, as we heard, a federal appeals court has upheld Michigan's emergency manager law. The Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals says the law does not violate voting rights. It does not racially discriminate. The court says there's no fundamental right to vote for local officials, and the state has a legitimate interest in fixing financially struggling local governments. In light of Monday's ruling upholding a decision from federal Judge George Stee, where does Michigan go from here? Wayne State University law professor Peter Hammer will be part of a panel exploring that question tomorrow at a forum put on by the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University. He is with us now. Peter, were you surprised by the appeals court ruling?
I was very disappointed, but I was not surprised. And the reason I'm not surprised is because current constitutional law is incredibly inadequate in dealing with issues of structural racism.
And the court says, you know, the law is imperfect, but it doesn't discriminate. Talk to us some more, especially knowing you're director for the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights.
Yeah, the need to be thinking about municipal distress from a historical perspective really teaches you that it's a convergence of sort of deindustrialization, white flight, failed regionalism, and structural racism. And so when the court can look at municipal distress, and I would say when the governor can look at municipal distress and the state looks at it and not see the legacy of structural racism, they're failing to see what's really there. And when you're blind, right, you're sort of blind justice. And this was an amazing illustration of really how inadequate existing understandings of constitutional law are to deal with the deeply troubling issues that we face for this generation.
So kind of taking the spreadsheet bottom line approach versus history.
Right. But I mean, think about what it means to have municipal distress when you have rising revenues, right? That's a sign of mismanagement. What does it mean to have municipal distress when you have a decade of sharply declining revenue? Right? You can't blame that on individuals. There's structural systemic problems. And when you come up with the mandate to do everything conceivable to balance the budget, what you're really doing is sort of the cruel economics of fiscal austerity. And you're creating second-class cities and second-class citizenship in places like Flint, in places like Pontiac, in places like Detroit.
And is the court then saying that if you live in these financially distressed cities under emergency management, you don't get a voice?
You have no rights. I mean, basically, this is another form of apartheid that says that if you are born in a zip code, and we know that the zip codes are highly racialized and opportunity is highly racialized, if you're born in the wrong zip code in this country, you do not have the same democratic rights as somebody born in a wealthy zip code.
What now? Legally, is this the final word or can they keep working their way up?
Well, two important things to know. The first is that Judge Stee did find that there was a potential constitutional violation of equal protection and dismissed that without prejudice to enable the appeal to go forward, right? So at a very minimum, I would hope to see a trial and a discussion about whether or not emergency management violates equal protection. Independent of that, on the range of other issues that were decided yesterday, there's a possibility of anything from an en banc appeal for the entire Sixth Circuit to trying to seek some form of certiorari review from the Supreme Court.
So that en banc appeal is exactly what we saw Attorney General Schuette endeavor with the straight ticket voting.
Right. And it's just sort of the logic. You get a decision by a panel and a strategic call to whether or not to go for an en banc review and then whether or not to seek a Supreme Court review.
Ultimately, what does this decision, in your feeling, mean for Michigan cities, Michigan schools?
Well, I think, and I would attribute this to the sort of crisis in Flint that was really a wake-up call. I would hope that independent of the constitutional review, that we've awoken from our slumber and really come to realize that emergency management is a deadly tool and has to be, if not repealed wholesale, very substantially reformed. So I'm very hopeful that the discussion tomorrow will really focus on the weaknesses as a policy level of emergency management, and it pushes responsibility back to the state legislature and the governor to come up with a policy fix. The fact that the Sixth Circuit didn't find a constitutional violation really provides them no shelter from doing the right thing, which is do substantial changes in the law.
Wayne State University law professor Peter Hammer will be part of the panel at the IPPSR's second September forum. It'll be tomorrow from 11:30 to 1:30 in the Mackinac Room on the fifth floor of the Anderson House office building right there in Lansing. It is free. It is open to the public. And I'm sure you're going to have a really interesting conversation, a lot to chew over, Peter Hammer.
Yeah, it will be a good discussion.
Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
My pleasure.
Are people writing from beyond the grave to support a proposed natural gas line, a line that would run from Ohio through southeast Michigan and on into Ontario? According to a story in today's Detroit Free Press, the answer is yes. Free Press writer Keith Matheny is here with us again. Keith, we're talking about the proposed Nexus pipeline. What would that do?
The Nexus pipeline would be a very large multi-state natural gas transmission line. It would take gas from the gas fields of western Pennsylvania and Ohio, move it through those states, would actually move it up into Michigan, and then on into Sarnia, Ontario.
And one of the big players is DTE Energy.
DTE Energy is a 50% owner, along with Enbridge, the Canadian Oil Transportation Corporation, and Spectra Energy, which Enbridge is in the process of attempting to acquire.
And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, what, is taking public comments and accepting letters and comments?
Right. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, is currently considering whether to give this pipeline the up or down, whether to approve it and allow it to move forward. As part of that process, they are accepting public comment, and that's where the story gets a little odd.
Absolutely. So tell us, what did you learn, Keith, about some of the letters supporting this pipeline?
There's a number of citizens groups that have kind of formed grassroots groups in Ohio, in Michigan, throughout the kind of this course of the line, who have various concerns about the Nexus project. Usually has to do with where it's sited, whether it's going through populated areas or what have you. One of those groups happened to notice what they thought looked a little fishy with a number of positive, supportive comments that had been submitted to FERC saying, please move ahead with this Nexus line. What really caught their attention was that a friend of theirs was listed as a letter writer, and they said, well, wait a minute, we don't think he would have said that. And they checked with his friend, and he confirmed, no, I didn't write that letter, and I never told anybody else to. So as they dug into it and looked at it more, they found a number of discrepancies similar to that, including an interesting one where a man named Glenn England, an Ohio resident, purportedly wrote a letter August 15th in support of this Nexus pipeline to FERC. Mr. England died 18 years ago. I actually spoke to his widow for part of the story.
Well, who filed these letters? What's their side of things?
Turns out the letters were filed by a consumer group called the Consumer Energy Alliance. They're an advocacy organization for energy projects. They say that their goal is basically affordable energy for people, for businesses, for residents. They claim that they conducted telephone surveys trying to gauge support for the Nexus pipeline, and if people in that automated telephone survey indicated support, they generated sort of a form letter in their name that was submitted to the federal regulator. They said that during those automated telephone interviews, there was a mention of the fact that if you agreed to do the survey, you were agreeing to also have your comments submitted to FERC.
Well, what's the excuse for getting comments from a gentleman who's been dead for 18 years?
What they believe happened is that their system is limited to whoever is named on the telephone account. So it could be that Mr. England's name is the name associated with that phone number that they called. But there may still be some problems with that because the citizens group that kind of ferreted this out says that they spoke to people who don't recall taking any telephone survey. And if they did, they don't recall anyone saying they were going to write a letter on their behalf. Now, the Consumer Energy Alliance counters that, hey, we have meticulous phone records of who we called. I'm not sure that's fully been vetted in terms of who's ultimately right here. They said that it's possible because this happened weeks ago, people might not remember the call that they agreed to take.
Hmm. What's DTE's version? Were you able to talk with anybody from DTE?
DTE quickly moved me over to its partner, Spectra, and Spectra's comments on the matter were pretty much a reiteration of Consumer Energy Alliance's response, which is, you know, hey, we did this survey. It was on the up and up. This is a widely used practice. And so there was nothing untoward here.
What questions does this raise, including could this type of these fishy letters present an opportunity for a legal challenge from opponents of the pipeline?
I actually spoke to a person with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service who indicated, you know, they wouldn't speak specifically about this because they haven't investigated it. But things like this where a letter is submitted to a government agency on behalf of someone who didn't give their permission for it could potentially be prosecutable under mail fraud statutes, according to this inspector. You know, one of the larger issues I see here is we already have instance after instance where people feel like, you know, their participation in public comment on these governmental projects doesn't really have any resonance in terms of impacting what ultimately happens. And the more you make that something that's kind of cynical and proven to be, you know, not real, you know, the more corrosive it is for that, perhaps.
Well, the story is at freep.com under a headline that Keith wrote, New Nexus Pipeline, Great Idea, says man who died in 1998. Definitely check out that story. Keith Matheny, Detroit Free Press. As always, Keith, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Department of Education says kids at mostly Black or Latino schools don't get as good of an education as kids at mostly white schools. Generally speaking, their teachers aren't as experienced and their buildings are in worse shape. You can see that in Detroit and Flint and other Michigan cities. There was a major Michigan court case that tried to end segregated schools and make it possible for children to have a good education no matter where they lived. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham, reporting for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, explains just how that court case might have made a difference.
From the 1950s on, white people started leaving Detroit and moving to the suburbs. By 1970, only one in three students at Detroit Public Schools was a white kid, and those white kids were concentrated in mostly white schools. Detroit schools were segregated. The school board was trying to come up with a plan to fix that, but it was getting pushback from white parents who didn't want to send their kids to Black schools. There was also pushback from forces within the Black community who wanted to keep Black schools Black and have more of a say in hiring more Black teachers and administrators in those schools. The school district board tried to find a compromise plan, but in the end, no one was happy with the modest desegregation plan that included busing kids in Detroit. It got so bad somebody threatened to kill a school board member. There were bomb threats. Students held walkouts. The Michigan legislature stepped in, and it passed a law that Senator Coleman Young sponsored. Young was later Detroit's first Black mayor. The law did give more local control over neighborhood schools, but it also legalized segregation in the Detroit schools by allowing white kids to leave their neighborhood's mostly Black school and transfer to one that was more white. The 1954 Supreme Court ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education ruled that the idea of racially separate but equal was anything but equal. In the South, government began enforcing school integration. In the North, it was a different story. By the 1970s, things were actually getting worse.
While the decisions in the southern states, the southern school districts, were moving toward implementation, the segregation and isolation, racial isolation in the North was increasing.
That's Nathaniel Jones. He had just been hired as the top lawyer of the NAACP when the new law in Michigan was passed. Detroit became a natural target for a desegregation lawsuit. The case became known as Bradley versus Milliken. Ronald Bradley was a young student in Detroit and the first named as a plaintiff. William Milliken was governor of Michigan. The case went to the U.S. District Court and ended up bouncing up to the appellate court a couple of times. Joyce Baugh is the author of the Detroit school busing case. She says when the U.S. District Court judge, Stephen Roth, decided there were not enough white students in Detroit for any meaningful integration, he decided the only way to end segregation was by busing black Detroit students to the white suburban districts and suburban kids to Detroit. White suburban residents were outraged.
They were basically saying that they didn't think that their kids should have to go to schools with these black kids because there would be all kinds of problems and more racial problems. Their kids wouldn't get a good education. They would be subject to violence, all of those kinds of things.
To give you an idea of how unpopular busing was at the time, a lawsuit to integrate Pontiac schools had argued for busing. Thousands of white parents and their kids took to the street to protest. The Ku Klux Klan used dynamite to blow up 10 empty Pontiac school buses. In the Milliken versus Bradley case, lawyers for the suburban districts argued they weren't the cause of segregated schools in Detroit. But Joyce Baugh says the trial court found that white people were leaving Detroit for the suburbs and keeping blacks out of the suburbs, which contributed to the segregation.
And the fascinating thing to me is if you look at the census data from 1970, there were 2,668,000 people living in the suburbs. Only 97,000 of them were African American.
The NAACP's lawyer, Nathaniel Jones, argued redlining by banks and real estate agencies, past policies by federal and state government agencies, all contributed to segregated housing and segregated schools.
That situation and phenomenon was not the result of happenstance. It was not accidental. It was a result of policies and practices that had been pursued by public officials in the North over time.
Jones also argued that school districts were basically units of state government since the state had authority over them. So they didn't have to prove an individual school district was segregated. State policies led to segregation throughout the Detroit region. The appeals court agreed. The state of Michigan and the mostly white suburban districts took the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. In the arguments archived by the Illinois Institute of Technology, Jones argued the case for the busing plan for Detroit and the suburbs.
A plan that promised to realistically work now and hereafter. A plan that would eliminate the vestiges of state-imposed segregation, that would eliminate the core of state-imposed black schools.
The Michigan Attorney General at the time, Frank Kelly, argued the state was not responsible and that the plan to bus students was out of line because the suburban districts did not cause the segregation. The
trial court ordered a desegregation plan, including 53 school districts involving 780,000 students and requiring at least 310,000 of them to be bused daily and the school days, so that each school, each grade, and each classroom would reflect the racial makeup of the entire 53 school district area.
When the Supreme Court handed down its decision in the summer of 1974, it ruled Detroit schools, with its 35% white student population, would have to figure out how to desegregate itself without the help of the ring of white suburbs surrounding it. Nathaniel Jones says the decision meant there would be no real desegregation in America's northern cities.
We argued the case to the Supreme Court, and in a 5-4 decision, they reversed the Sixth Circuit and the trial judge, saying that we had not proven that the suburbs had participated in creating the segregation in Detroit.
Among the justices who disagreed with the majority was Thurgood Marshall. He saw the ruling in Milliken versus Bradley as a dismantling of the landmark ruling Brown versus the Board of Education, which he had won just 20 years before.
Our nation, I fear, will be ill-served by this court's refusal to remedy separate and unequal education, for unless our children begin to learn together, there is little hope that our people will ever learn to live together and understand each other.
Today, the Detroit Public School District is 84% black. The district has been a financial mess with deteriorating schools for decades. African Americans have made inroads into the suburbs. Those suburban schools quickly change into majority black schools as many whites move or use school of choice laws to send their kids to a neighboring majority white district. There's no sign that pattern will change. With the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Can Northwest Lower Michigan support a professional theater group that dares to really challenge audiences, delivering theater for the adventurous mind, not comfortable, not touristy and familiar? It turns out the answer is yes. The Parallel 45 Theater Company mounted its very first production in Elk Rapids in 2010, Thornton Wilder's Our Town. And it clearly struck a receptive chord because Parallel 45 is preparing to open its seventh season. Erin Anderson Whiting is with us now. She's the executive director of Parallel 45. Hello, Erin.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to have you with us. And we get to say hello to artistic director Kit McKay. Hello, Kit.
Hi.
The slogan right at the top of the website reads, Familiar Stories for the Adventurous Mind. Erin, why does that sum up the mission you see for Parallel 45?
We hope to reach the biggest audience we possibly can. So we want to draw people in with something that feels inclusive. So stories, they at least, even if they don't know them terribly well, they're going to be familiar titles, something they've heard of, maybe read a long time ago, so that they feel drawn in and somewhat comfortable. And then we're going to change things up a bit. We're going to kind of turn things on their heads and give a new perspective to some of these stories. Look at them from a different angle, look at them through a new lens, and hopefully that's going to make these stories more relevant, more interesting, and visceral to today's audiences.
Kit, you and Erin go back a few years. You met at Interlochen Arts Academy, and then you reconnected a few years later at Sarah Lawrence?
That's correct.
And then how and when did the idea that you two were going to build this professional theater company in Northwest Lower Michigan hatch and grow? I mean, you came back to Michigan from New York and Chicago.
Well, Erin and I were very close friends and colleagues all through our 20s, and she and I stayed in touch. And I was just coming out of grad school at Northwestern in Chicago, and she came up to visit, and we went out to dinner, and she sat me down and said, rather than embark on a freelance career as a director, why don't you bring the theater you think is relevant and adventurous, why don't you bring that to Michigan? Where the audience is sophisticated and smart and very open-minded. And that's exactly what we did. I decided to move to Michigan and begin starting the work.
Well, Erin, what was it about that area around Traverse City, that northwest corner of the Lower Peninsula, that made it feel right for you to do this?
Well, it's my home, so I'm a native Northwest Lower Michigan lady. So, of course, I have a certain soft spot there. But also the community at the time, you know, this was 2008, 2009, we were hatching this idea. The community was really starting to shift in terms of its artistic offerings. The Traverse City Film Festival was up and running and really exceeding everyone's expectations for the kind of art it was bringing and the kinds of audiences that were coming out to see it. And there was a lot of other exciting stuff happening. And of course, there's Interlochen here. And it really gave us confidence that, you know what, the audiences here are happy to have something different, something that perhaps you would think could only survive in a larger market. But for our small market, we have some really sophisticated art lovers who are willing to try something new. And let's not just do the same old, same old. Let's try something new and see what the response is.
So give us a sense of how you changed up a really familiar production. You're doing A Christmas Carol in Prose to launch your new season from December 1st to the 11th. How will that be different from the Christmas Carol that we all know so well?
So the Christmas Carol we all know and love so well is a big, beautiful, traditional spectacle. It brings every scene to life. It is a very visual and musical affair. We are stripping down this production to its core essence. We're taking Dickens' original language, and we're doing it in the Reader's Theater style with six actors playing all the roles. And we're letting the audience's imagination contribute to the theatrical experience. So you won't be seeing a lot of visual, spectacular effects. But you will be engaged using your imagination.
And it's got to be fun for the actors to really focus on vocalizing this and putting life into what they're doing and playing a lot of different characters.
Absolutely. And that is actually something that we do a lot. We take things, we engage very simply and allow the actors to do the bulk of the work.
Well, I got to say, I still remember years and years ago, I couldn't get to New York to see it, but it was recorded on public television. And that was the Royal Shakespeare Company doing Nicholas Nickleby, where you had what, 15 or 20 actors doing some crazy number of roles over hours, but it was amazing to watch some really gifted actors slip in and out of different characters.
Absolutely.
Have you hit that golden ring of selling out a run?
We have. We were so thrilled last April when our production of A Streetcar Named Desire sold out the whole run.
Which had to have been a big aha moment for you and Kit to say, all right, we sold a run out. That's a real vote of confidence.
Exactly. We were thrilled. It was, you know, Streetcar Named Desire is a very popular show. Most people have heard it, perhaps seen it, certainly seen the movie. So we went into it feeling relatively confident it would sell well. But selling out the whole thing was really sort of the icing on the cake for a lot of years of work. Of trying to get known in the community and the surrounding region, and to entice people to come see something that maybe they've seen before, and to encourage them that, hey, this is going to be a little different. Even if you think you know Streetcar, come check this out.
Now, talk to us about the difference in what you're doing with this professional theater company. I underline that word professional versus community theater. I bet a lot of that has to do with money and hiring performers and crew. They laugh.
It does.
There's a real synergy between community theater and professional theater, not just in this thriving cultural landscape, but in every community. And it's been really, really lovely working with the Old Town Playhouse here in town. We do very different things. We happen to have a really talented group of actors and designers and directors in the area. And Old Town Playhouse is extraordinarily successful because of that. And we work in a very different niche in that we bring people from New York and LA and Chicago and Europe and all across the country to work alongside this talent.
And I suspect if I get an appeal from you to come to beautiful Traverse City, beautiful, that whole beautiful Northwest Lower Peninsula area, I'm going to say yes. You've got a lot. You've got a nice selling point for an actor who's stuck in a corner apartment in London.
Yes.
Oh, exactly. It does not hurt that you're asking them to come to a beautiful place, a place that's known as a vacation destination, to spend a few weeks. That definitely is a selling point for us. But everyone is paid. That's right. You mentioned that before. Mm-hmm. So everyone involved with any aspect of the organization is paid for their work. And that's something we feel really strongly about because we understand how difficult it is for those who've chosen to have a career in any of the arts, but particularly in the theater, to be able to make a living. And every year we strive to raise the amount of money that we're paying these artists so that we can get closer and closer to that living wage.
And I know that you have initiated educational efforts going into area schools, so it sounds like you're trying to plant seeds to bring up a new crop of theater babies.
Always.
That's right. Always, because you always need new audience. And we have some wonderful public and private schools in the region who really do value the performing arts a great deal. But of course, there's a lot of struggles, you know, budget cuts in many public schools. The first casualty is arts programs. So it's wonderful to be able to incorporate these students in our performances. This past season, we had, for Medea and Streetcar both, we did 11 a.m. school matinees. And students from local public and private schools were bused in. And then after the performance, we did a Q&A with the actors and other artists. And the students could eat their lunch and ask questions. And we hope to continue doing more of that in the future.
Well, you can get all the details on that upcoming season of Parallel 45 by going to their website, parallel45.org. Erin Anderson Whiting and Kit McKay of Parallel 45, all born in the classrooms of Interlochen Arts Academy. And here you are bringing the arts to Michigan. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What happens when you're the parent of a child who has special needs and your view of how you want your child to be educated clashes with the view of the school district? Melody Arabu is a mother who's been fighting that battle with the Walled Lake Consolidated School District. Now, if her name sounds familiar, it's because we spoke with her here on Stateside when she was named Michigan's Teacher of the Year for 2014-2015. Today, we speak with her as a mom. Melody Arabu, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Your twin sons, Ashton and Adam, had some developmental and speech challenges, both at a preschool classroom for children with special needs. Why was that?
Yes, so we started noticing their delays at around 1.5 when they weren't walking. And so we enrolled them for services through early on. And then that led to special education preschool because they were able to, while going to school, get physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech, and other services built in.
But then when it came time to go to kindergarten, you wanted to have the boys placed into a general education classroom in their neighborhood school, which is Keith Elementary. Why was that important to you, Melody?
Well, I mean, that was always our plan for them. So we thought that the preschool program would be a good way for them to, you know, get some extra support and, you know, try to catch them up as much as possible. But our intention was always for them to, you know, be part of their home community and go to school where their sister goes to school.
And then the Walled Lake District said, well, no, we think the boys would do better in a school with specialized support for children with cognitive disabilities. And that school was about a 20-minute drive from Keith. How did you feel about that decision?
Yeah, you know, it was about a 20-minute drive, and then we kind of estimated probably about 40 minutes by bus, which, you know, is definitely something we wanted to consider because that makes a long day for the kids. But really, you know, we did a lot of research and found that most data shows that inclusion is what works best for kids, and inclusion in their homeschool is proven to be the most effective because our goals for them in the future is for them to be active members of our community. And so these are the kids that they will grow up with, that they'll probably work with in the future, that they'll run into at the grocery store, that they'll be part of with school events and even sporting events.
Now, you came to an agreement with the district that Adam and Ashton would have, we'll call it a trial period, in a general education classroom at Keith. How did things go?
Well, we actually were pleased with the way things were going. We didn't really know what to expect because their communication is their biggest barrier, but they were socializing, they were making friends, they were making progress toward their IEP goals. It was a very positive experience from our perspective for the boys, and so we were happy.
And but yet, 8 weeks into that, the district decided no, they were going to They wanted to move your boys to that special education classroom, that self-contained classroom at Meadowbrook Elementary. And how did that change then the discussion between you and the district?
Well, I mean, it's definitely something that we needed to learn more about. So we needed to make sure we knew our rights. We needed to make sure we understood the dispute resolution process. It was definitely brand new for us. And we, you know, reached out to some other parents that we knew were in similar situations. We really started to work together. We reached out to some advocates. We started consulting with attorneys. We just really wanted to understand what our rights were and then also what our kids' rights were so that they made sure to get the right education.
And then here in January, as you're dealing with all of this, you really were hit with just an unbelievable tragedy as Ashton passed away from encephalitis after getting the flu. I remember reading about that, and I knew we had talked with you on this program. And I tell you, our hearts all went out to you, and I hope that you were feeling the good thoughts of people from all over as we heard that news.
Thank you. Yeah, everybody was just amazing and so supportive.
And yet, and that did not deter you from your fight to keep Adam at Keith Elementary. And in doing so, you decided to file a complaint with the Michigan Department of Education. What was the complaint about, Melody, and why did you feel that was necessary?
Well, we knew that the state complaint process was free for both parties, so we felt that that was a better route to go than due process. It's less adversarial, you know, it's kind of giving the details and facts to the Michigan Department of Education, and someone from the Office of Special Education will, you know, investigate, and they have this whole process. So we felt that would be a good option. And so the three things that were really outlined were the dispute over placement and making sure that the free and appropriate public education was in the least restrictive environment. The second one was about the trial contracts. When we had signed them in the summer, we did not realize that they were not common practice and that there were some questions to the legalities of that. And then the third thing was an arbitration agreement that the district wanted us to sign to bring in a third party to try to resolve it.
And before the state completed its investigation based on that complaint of Walled Lake Consolidated Schools, the district filed a due process complaint that stopped the state investigation from moving forward. And then after a two-week-long hearing in July, the administrative law judge just ruled in favor of the district. That ruling came September 2nd. And we'll be talking shortly with an attorney from the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services for a legal view of that. But for your family, for your boy, what does this mean for Adam?
You know, this is like the next stage of the process. We really were depending on the state to make a decision in this, and we felt that it was going in one direction, and then that got kind of turned around, and we ended up in due process, which is costly and adversarial and very taxing, and it was not our choice to do that, but we did. And now we're realizing that different people see things differently, even at a state level. So what the state found is different from what the law judge found. And so we're really kind of left in this space of inconsistency, and that's a little bit frustrating. So we're looking into some other avenues for Adam, but we still so strongly believe in inclusion. We so strongly believe that he would benefit tremendously from being at his home school and being able to watch and learn from his peers and be able to hear good language models, because that's his biggest barrier. And you know what? He's part of our community. He had a great kindergarten year. After his brother passed away, the kids and the families and the teachers just, you know, took such good care of him. And this is his home. He's got best friends. He's going to play soccer with his friends on a team. And he has the ability to learn and grow here. And so that's what we're going to keep focusing on and find the best way to do that.
Melody, I'm sure there are people who would say that the staff who work with special needs students know what it takes for that student to succeed and what the best environment is. How do you think school districts should balance those recommendations of the special education teachers and staff with what parents want for their child?
Right. And I think that makes this case unique in the sense that I am a teacher and I have been a teacher for 15 years. I've had students every year in my class who are not at third grade level. I mean, I've had kids who come in at kindergarten level for reading, or even kids who can read at a high school level. So our district is very strong in differentiation and training the teachers to work with kids of all levels and all needs. And so I think the separation between special education and general education is probably at the root of the issue. I know that's something that Lieutenant Governor Calley and the Special Education Task Force that I participated in are trying to move toward, that this is just education for all, and all kids fit onto a continuum of need, and we provide teachers with the right resources and training to meet those needs, and it doesn't have to just be special ed teachers working with special ed kids.
And what would you say to other parents of children who have special needs listening to our conversation right now and wondering how to advocate for their children?
I think it's just never giving up. You know, in our case, we're getting different answers from different people. And so I think it just shows how broken the system is. And I'm not ready to give up in any way, shape, or form yet. And I'm not only advocating for Adam, but I'm advocating for the other families I've connected with across the state. And I think just all across Michigan, we can do a better job of serving kids with special needs and making sure that their civil rights are intact and that they get the same opportunities that all other kids get.
Melody Arabu, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today on Stateside.
Thank you again.
And Melody joined us via Skype. And now we turn to Mark McWilliams, an attorney with the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service. It's an independent nonprofit that advocates for the rights of people with disabilities. Mark, as we heard Melody describe, here we have parents of a child with disabilities. They want their child to be in a gen ed classroom, experiencing everything and everyone that entails. And the district says, no, we think your child would do better in a classroom with a teacher specifically there to support children with special needs. Just what is the district's legal responsibility toward that child?
the district is responsible to provide special education and support services and supports to try to help a child get into school and to try to get in to general education and to learn and succeed just like everyone else as much as possible. That's the original premise of both the federal and the state special education laws.
So when we see this kind of situation where they're truly at loggerheads, who has the trump card here?
Well, it's really challenging for parents to be able to voice any kind of disagreement with what schools decide their child should be getting. There are a number of different ways that you can resolve disagreements. There are a number of informal ways. You can try to negotiate through the IEP process. You can go to mediation. There is a process called IEP facilitation. But if you can't solve the problem that way, the formal responses that you have really are either to file an administrative complaint with the state if you think that the school is not following the law in some way, or you have the option of requesting a due process hearing. This is an interesting situation because because in this case, the parent, I think, decided to file an administrative complaint. And the district then responded by requesting a due process hearing instead.
Right. And what is that all about? What is a due process hearing and a due process claim?
Well, under federal and state special education law, if there's a disagreement and the parent and the district can't work it out, either party has the right to request a due process hearing, which is a hearing before an administrative law judge from the state, where you essentially present your case and then the administrative law judge decides. It's really designed for parents to be able to voice disagreement. It's not really designed for districts to come in and use it as an opportunity to try to stop parents from getting what they're after for their kid.
Which is what apparently has happened in the case for Melody Arabu and her family, because when the district filed its due process complaint, that stopped the state investigation from moving forward. And then there was a 2-week-long hearing in July. And then on September 2nd, the administrative law judge rules in favor of the district. So does that slam the door shut for the family?
No. There is a right to appeal a due process hearing decision to either federal or state court. Let me say something, though, about the due process hearing, in case you're thinking it's a relatively informal affair. It really is not. It's a full-blown legal proceeding in most cases. There are lawyers involved in most cases. If a parent requested a due process hearing or is involved in a due process hearing, the district will almost always have an attorney representing them. The attorney, of course, has a responsibility to zealously represent their client, who is the school district. And so unless a parent has counsel, it's very, very difficult for a parent to participate and have their voice heard in that process.
Difficult and, dare I say, expensive?
And very expensive. That is, if you can find an attorney who will do the cases. Our agency does very few due process hearings because we have a very small number of attorneys and we have a lot of other work we have to do in the state. There are very few now, very few private attorneys in Michigan who will do the cases. So if you can find an attorney to represent you as a parent, that's one thing. And if you can, it's going to cost you a lot of money. My view is that the process, from the parent's point of view, is fundamentally broken. It's also expensive for districts. Now, districts have insurance in many cases that will pay for their costs in these hearings, but it's still very expensive.
I'm talking with Mark McWilliams, who's an attorney with Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service, as we talk about where the rights stand when a parent feels that their child with learning disabilities should be in a general education classroom, and the district says, no, we think the child should be in a classroom with a teacher specifically there to support children who have special needs. There have been some changes, Mark, made to the dispute resolution process after recommendations from the Special Education Reform Task Force, which was headed up by Lieutenant Governor Callie. What can you tell us about these changes and why they were made and why they were needed?
Sure. The Lieutenant Governor's Task Force started to look at dispute resolution and made a number of recommendations, including increasing the use of mediation, trying to strengthen the complaint process. We had seen that the Department of Education had started to make progress, in our view, in improving the complaint process and making it more accountable so that the school districts could be held responsible for following the laws. And recently there have been some slowing of those efforts to make reforms, and so we're concerned about that. We would, of course, like to see the reforms go forward and see the state be able to hold districts accountable for their responsibilities.
So it doesn't come to the point of having to go through this due process claim.
Right. I for anybody who's been through a due process hearing, either a lawyer or a parent or a school person, it's really not a pleasant situation. And if we can figure out a way to do something better, something that is child oriented, that focuses on getting children in school, making sure that they're learning alongside their non-disabled peers, and making progress toward doing what every other kid in school wants to do, and that is to graduate and be successful as an adult.
So this case that we've explored, talking with Melody Arabu and now kind of talking with you, well, what do you think it brings to the large discussion we should be having in this state about parent participation and the rights of students with special needs?
Well, I think that it brings, first of all, the idea that students with disabilities are students first, and that you look at their needs in many ways the same way you would look at the needs of any other student. When students with disabilities are struggling, it's a bellwether of how students in general can be doing. And how we treat students with disabilities is a good bellwether of how you treat all our students. So, we have expectations of special education that somehow there's some kind of magic solution that you're going to get in the special education setting, when what you're looking at really is you're looking at providing the kind of individual look at a student and individual supports that sometimes are not that complicated, to really help the student be part of the community and part of the school. And I think that with good dispute resolution, recognizing that conflict is really a natural part of this field because the stakes are high. People care very much about their students, and teachers are deeply committed to what they do. The conflict is something that's almost inevitable. And once you recognize that and recognize a humane and meaningful way of making sure that parents have a real say in that and have an incentive to work together on behalf of students, that's when we do our best.
Mark McWilliams is with the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service. Mark, thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome.
The Walled Lake Consolidated School District sent us a lengthy written response in regards to these interviews. Here's what they wrote in part. Walled Lake Consolidated Schools provides specific educational services in varied locations across our district. Students attend the school best suited to meet their specific needs. This approach in providing educational services is a reality in most districts, not only in Michigan, but across our country. Parents may disagree, and the district will seek to find collaborative solutions that ensure an education of excellence for both the individual student and the other students in the classroom. It's important to note that this occurs for both special needs students and students desiring specialized approaches to education. You can read the entire response by going to michiganradio.org and click on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors include April Van Buren, Tony Brown, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.